evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear three other guys who are co-net control people. John, KC2WGB, Paul, WS2N. Paul gives us the space report. John gives us the mailbag information, among other things. And Hal, K6DPZ, teaching us how to be more brief. The TechNet has been meeting now for 31 years this month, and this is TechNet number 1,468. I got the numbers a little bit mixed up from time to time. And it's been evolving. In the beginning, it was a one-hour thing. It's now a four-hour session that begins at 8 o'clock and ends at midnight. The machine just turned off at midnight at my request, because some people get so enthusiastic it would go on until the sun rises again. Let me drop it. And what the TechNet has evolved into is a kind of a schedule, a slightly loose schedule, where for the first hour people sign in and give us their call letters, their name, and the word yes, which means they do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in just because you're listening. After 31 years, we believe somebody is listening. After that, it's followed by, but that's usually about an hour's worth of quick questions and answers, so-called quick questions and answers. Followed by the mailbag, where some of these very smart guys who don't yet have their ham license or don't yet have the equipment to talk directly to us on the TechNet send things to John by snail mail, carrier pigeon, or email or whatever. And we cover a few of those. Followed by Paul telling us the latest at what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. And after that, we go into deeper subjects for the remainder of the time. That's the usual schedule. Let me drop. And if we were super disciplined people, that's the schedule we would have stuck to. Last week, we got way off of that schedule. The one-hour section that was supposed to go from 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock of brief questions and answers didn't last 1 hour. It lasted 2 hours and 15 minutes. We went from 8 o'clock till 10:15. In my opinion, for very good reasons, September 15th, the Ides of September, I think was a breakthrough date. In other words, a very simple question by Joe, KC2QIW, was asked about, are we amateurs going to be able to hold on to our frequencies? That branched into the frequencies that are being used by over the television, and that branched into what I'm calling the lie of, we were told that when we went over to digital television, we'd get all of these benefits and no disadvantages, and inadvertently, that turned out to be a lie. Well, we got into the discussion of that, and we started getting hot and heavy, where there were about five or six guys lined up who all wanted to make comments on the subject in hand, the breakthrough that took place. I'll give you a little more description of that after John gives us the mailbag. In other words, it's going to take a full 15 minutes to explain what took place. A number of people standing by didn't get a chance to answer their question, didn't get a chance to get onto their subject because that one lasted so long. A highly disciplined person, let me drop it. A highly disciplined person would have cut it off at exactly 1 hour, the quick-ass question and answer section. And because we did not, because I sensed that something else was taking place, I let it go on. And to my knowledge, it was a very good thing to do. I believe it's a bit of a breakthrough. I'll give you a 15 or 20 minute discussion later on as to what took place. If you happen to be listening to it, I think you heard a piece of history, but that's an opinion. I don't know if anyone's going to agree with that. Okay, it's time for you guys to give me your call letters and name and the word yes, which means you do have a question or comment. Do that right now, K2RIW listening.
And here we are. Well, that
prediction after poll. Only if you have a diaphragm, because if you didn't read the email, then probably it doesn't make sense to discuss that.
KB2IQN, Chris, yes.
Okay, so far we've got Rich, Wes, and some guy named Chris, which just happens to be my harmonic. I bet you're your mobile. Out of curiosity, where are you located, Chris?
At the present moment, I'm approaching the Cross County Parkway.
Very good. Know where you are. Okay. So we've got Rich. Oh, yeah. not sure you have a real question, but glad to hear you're on from your new Massapequa Park location, Wes and Chris. Anyone else assigned in with a question or a comment for the net, give me your call letters right now. KQLIW listening.
This is KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey. Name here is Joe, and yes.
Gravitas 2M. What's the space report? John? Dick?
Okay, we got Hal and Paul that time. Joe and Paul. And Joe was the guy that kicked us off with that very innocent sounding question last week. Oh boy. And that question went on for 2.25 hours, and that's when it triggered what I believe is a breakthrough. You'll be hearing about that later on. One last call. Anyone else to check in because they've got a question or a comment? Give me a call letters and name right now. KQLIW listening.
KQLIW, K6DPZ here for the quickie answers.
Kipawat 2, Mike Victor Radio. Name is Joe. In the Bronx. And yes.
Okay, we got Hal and Joe in the Bronx. Mike Victor Radio. I missed your prefix. Something number 2, Mike Victor Radio. What was that, Joe?
Yes, Dick, it's K2, MVR, Kilowatt 2.
Very fine. Obviously, you've had your call letters for a while, or it's a reissue. All right, we got more than enough to get going. Rich, why don't you give us a quick report as to how things are going in Massapequa Park? Has Barry come by to put up an antenna yet? You're sounding better and better as time goes on. N2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening, Dick. No, I don't have any questions. I am doing a little better health-wise, which is good. I still have a lot of pain in my back from the, I had like 10 hours of surgery in one shot in North Shore Hospital, so it's left its soul. But I'm doing okay, all things considered. I haven't put up an antenna yet. I am using a mobile whip sitting on a pipe. Getting over that thing?
Yes, you are. We know you're using a mobile whip on a pipe plate, and sounds like you're moving along very nicely. And I know that the healing of a back is always a slow process, Rich. That's a given. Let me go over to Wes for a minute. Wes, those two beautiful pictures you mailed us today with reference to your electron microscope. I am very curious. Those two pictures of the electron microscope, are they still at the location where it's starting, or has it already been moved to Queens, to your QTH? N2XJM, a guy who's going to have an electron microscope. K2LAW, go ahead, Wes.
It's from my location. They're in the front house, in the basement. And actually very much match the floor. I love it. Yeah, I built it yesterday, so I'm very much proud. It's about 2,000 pounds of copper. And tertiary.
Fantastic. Probably the number of ham radio operators in the United States who have in their possession an electron microscope. You may be the first, or at least I guarantee you can be counted on one hand. That's a rather rare opportunity. So only a scientist would be digging that deep, Wes, and good luck with that project. Christopher, I hope you're still in a good location, KB2IQN. I think you had a question. And go right ahead, KB2IQN, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Did you pick my second email?
I got the email with the two pictures, and I didn't get anything beyond that. I got an email last week, but I didn't get anything beyond that tonight. And I haven't checked in my email for the last hour and a half, so that could be part of it. Christopher, KB2IQN, K2LAW, go ahead.
Roger, KB2IQN. My question relates to ham radio when it comes to remote control craft. In other words, radio controls for over ham radio. I know there are frequencies around 50 to 53 megahertz that are available for, because we, at the NEAT fair, they had a channel board with 50 to 53 megahertz channels for those. But I'm wondering if A, there are other channels, you know, and other ham bands available, B, how much power we're allowed to transmit in those frequencies, and C, whether there are any radio control sets for ham radio that allow telemetry capability. So those are my questions, like, you know, RC over ham radio. Go ahead.
I can remember what the rules were at one time, Chris, and I think those rules probably have changed a couple of times. To my knowledge, particularly on the VHF frequencies, a ham radio operator is allowed to use essentially any frequency to communicate with his boat, car, airplane, whatever. Any ham radio frequency, to my knowledge. Where things get a little bit sticky is that, in theory, you're supposed to give an identification once every 10 minutes by some ordinary means, voice, Morse code, or whatever. So if you, it is my belief, and maybe somebody's going to correct me on this, it's my belief that if you decided to choose your own private frequency in the 1296 ham band, for instance, to control your aircraft, and as long as you get around the problem of identifying every so often, I believe you're allowed to run 1,000 watts, which is the usual ham radio frequency power output capability. And that would give you an awful lot of range if you wanted to. So I think that's allowed. Somebody's going to correct me on that one, I believe. Yes, there are standard frequencies that have been set aside. Let me drop. By gentleman's agreement, there were standard frequencies set aside in the 53 meg band, for instance, and also for a while there were some frequencies set aside in the 432 megacycle band, where commercial companies were manufacturing that equipment to be supplied to people with a ham license. And the main motivation for doing it in those days was that the majority of radio-controlled equipment was running on 72 megs, and there was a definite frequency limitation. That's the reason why you go to any particular event. They had a so-called frequency close-pin board. They had a board with all the frequencies marked on close-pins, and you were not allowed to turn your transmitter on unless that close-pin was on your antenna, and all the transmitters were impounded, because if somebody turned on a transmitter by mistake, the airplane that was in the air just suddenly crashed because we're seeing two transmitters at once. That was the old days on 72 megs. And along came the 2 gigahertz band, which an awful lot of radio control equipment manufacturers started using. Let me drop. And the magic of 2 gigs is that there's a whole lot of bandwidth there. The manufacturers started using various kinds of spread spectrum techniques, various kinds of direct sequence codes, so that when you do what's called the bundling or marrying or whatever it's called, in other words, you set up your transmitter, you set up your receiver, and the transmitter goes through a program where it selects a frequency that it believes is not being used on the air at that time, selects a code. The receiver also receives the information, knows what the code is, and from then on only looks at that particular code on that particular set of frequencies. And the net result is that Christopher and I were at a radio control event called NEAT, Northeast Aero Electronic Technology, Aero Electronic Technology, I guess is what NEAT stands for, that was held in Chernobyl, New York. And there was one particular event where approximately 30 aircraft were in the air simultaneously, all simultaneously using the 2 gig band and all those frequencies. Let me drop. All those frequencies kept completely separate from each other, even around the 2 gig band. And I suspect some of those transmitters were choosing the high end, the medium end, or the low end of the band. But even beyond that, they were choosing individual spread spectrum codes, and the receiver knew to look at only that code and ignore everything else. It's called the orthogonality technique for certain kinds of modulation techniques that obey something that's called a gold code. So there's a whole chunk of electronics technology that has been added to RC in the last 10 years or so that is such that you no longer need a frequency pin. You no longer need to impound the transmitters. Anybody can turn on a transmitter anywhere, and it talks to your particular receiver and nobody else. And so, as I see it now, much of the motivation for going to the ham radio frequencies has almost been removed, with the one exception. You can run higher power. Most radio control transmitters are running in the vicinity of half a watt, to my knowledge. And as a ham radio operator, you could, in theory, build, let me drop. You could build a receiver that is very dead, very high in noise figure, very low in sensitivity. And by way of using a whole lot of transmit power, you can talk to it and essentially nobody else could. You could choose that approach if you wanted to, or to choose an approach where the thing you're talking to that's flying in the air could be what's called first-person flying. In other words, there's a camera on board. The feedback, the radio link from that camera goes back to a set of goggles that are being used by the pilot. The pilot now has the ability to fly the airplane beyond line of sight, and he can see where it's going because he's acting like the pilot as if he's on board looking on what the camera is seeing. In that particular circumstance, you'd like to run a whole lot of power on the transmitter to make sure that when your particular aircraft is behind a tree, behind a building, or whatever, you still had control to it. Bunch of opinions you just heard. Not necessarily the whole answer. I'd like to believe that within the sound of my voice right now, there are radio-controlled, smarter people than me who can tell us the answers to Christopher's questions. What frequencies, what powers, legality, telemetry, feedback, anything about radio control that you know with current rules and regulations, please give us your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet. Doesn't completely surprise me. Christopher and I were at this event where there were approximately 375 registered pilots with AMA licenses. The Academy of Model Aeronautics is an organization in the United States that once you join it, it gives you $10 million of liability insurance when you fly your airplane, your boat, your car, or whatever, when you're registered with them. And so everybody has to have that license in order to be at this event and to be legally declared as a pilot. One of the things that Christopher and I noticed that's very unusual to me is that his radio control enthusiast is heavily dependent on his radio. You would think, therefore, a ham radio operator and a radio control model airplane flyer would be one and the same person. Christopher and I believe that. You go to an event with 350 registered pilots, 375 pilots, and two of them had a ham radio license. That's an extremely small ratio by my standards. By the same token, among the ham radio operators we talked to, the number of new fly RC airplanes is, again, very small. Why there isn't a bigger overlap between those two hobbies is kind of amazing to me. Maybe somebody's got an explanation for that one. If you've got any further information about radio control and ham radio in the mixture, give us your call letters right now. K2LAW in the TechNet. Okay, I think somebody did attempt to get in. That particular signal was 95% noise, 5% audio, and nothing could be heard. So you're going to have to move to another location, use a little more power, aim the antenna a little bit better. So one more call. Anyone with any information about current radio control, and by the way, while we're waiting for somebody to decide they're going to give us words on this, I do remember that when Harry Danels, who was the president of the American Radio Relay League for about 11 years, lived in Dix Hills, I live in Dix Hills, a section of Huntington. So Harry and I would talk frequently, and I would send emails to him and whatever. We drop. And there was a period of time in which the frequencies at 72 megs and other frequencies like at 53 megs were being assigned, which frequencies are being allowed to use for a boat, which frequencies for a car, which frequencies for an airplane, whether or not it interfered and overlapped with ham radio. Should the American Radio League be involved in the frequency selection committee that the AMA, the Academy of Model Aeronautics, was doing. And of course, both of those organizations were interfacing with the FCC. So I, as an AMA member at that time, was receiving a Model Aviation magazine, reading these articles and interpreting them and sending that information to Harry so that he would have, at least for me, direct input as to what was going on with the mixture between radio control and ham radio, and whether or not the two of them can remain compatible, which of course they did, because we ham radio operators have a hell of a lot of spectrum given to us. every octave of the band is a significant number of megahertz that we're allowed to use. We're allowed to transmit, and most of them are near 1,000 watts of a transmitter power output. And everything that we create with our own hands, every receiver, transmitter, and whatever, is essentially type accepted by the FCC, which is kind of amazing. You take any other commercial service, let me drop it, and you must be using a transmitter that has full FCC approval and has gone through a qualification procedure. You must have a license. You must go onto a waiting list in order to get a frequency assigned to you so that you could dispatch your taxi cabs or your oil delivery service or whatever. What a commercial service has to do to go, what they have to go through to get one particular frequency assigned to them and to get one piece of electronics that they're allowed to use, by your and my standards, it's a lot of rigmarole. And you just take that license, which we essentially get for free, and you're getting zillions of frequencies given to you free of charge. It's one hell of a resource that you should appreciate. Part of the reason why that takes place is that we've made extremely good use of it in the past. We're rather good at policing our own frequencies, if anything not so pleasant is taking place. We also supply a lot of information when it comes to emergency services to protect life and limb when hurricanes, air crashes, and whatever take place, tornadoes. And the ham radio operators in that legal testing ground where they're allowed to go to any one of these frequencies, transmit, receive, talk to other people, and so on, the ham radio operators have done an extremely good job of developing new electronics. Let me drop this. Way back in the late 50s and 60s, ham radio operators were doing something called phone patch, by which they would set up various pieces of electronics so that their over-the-air ham radio signals could then be coupled into a local telephone. And when it comes to people who were at a theater of war talking back home, that was being supplied. Later, the ham radio operators start doing a more advanced version of phone patching in which touchtone pads through a local 2-meter repeater, for instance, was connecting you to a phone line. It just turns out that the major developer of the cell phone, and there's something like 6 billion cell phones in the world being used right now, and one very unsung hero, Dr. Reed Fisher, W2CQH, of Bell Laboratories in New Jersey, is the major developer of a cell phone. So there's a big tie-in between ham radio, protection of people, and development of hardware, as you can tell. And you go to, you do a Google search on who invented the cell phone, and you'll get an answer of Mr. Cooper, a guy from Motorola, who did make the first cell phone call with equipment that was assembled by Motorola. But it was using the concept developed by Reed Fisher, and very few people know about that. So, I'm not sure we've given you much of an answer yet, Chris. Drag your feet a little bit when I pass it back to you in case somebody else came out of the woodwork with some kind of knowledge about radio control, ham radio, the mixture, and the frequencies we're allowed to use and the procedures we're allowed to use. If anybody has more direct information, correct me. Don't worry about that. Give me your call letters right now before Chris picks up. KB2IQN with a little bit of delay. K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2IL, comment.
Glad to hear from you, Bernie. Go right ahead. I hope you're a radio control flyer.
No, I'm not, but there's definitely band space in the ARRL's band plan for such experimentation. So you can pretty much go anywhere you want, and as Nick, as you said, all you need to do is make sure you ID and abide by the power limits of your license. The second point I want to make was a question. Dick, did you guys make it to the Makers Fair this weekend? There were a number of booths dedicated to radio-controlled, what I'm going to call helicopters, multi-bladed helicopters. It was actually quite interesting.
KDDT with Intel. Hey, DDT or something like that said very fast. We're going to pick you up in a second. Bernie first. Bernie, no, we didn't get a chance to go to that fair. Please tell us what we missed. Tell us what you saw. One of the things that Christopher frequently and I see when we go to these radio control events are these guys that fly very high power sometimes, radio control helicopters that can do all kinds of crazy maneuvers that no real helicopter can do. like sustained inverted flight. And sometimes so low to the ground, they literally can mow the lawn with the darn thing. And there was somebody who got heavily injured about 2 weeks ago with one of those things, so they can be a little bit dangerous. So tell us what you saw at this event this weekend, Bernie. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2LAW.
Well, my estimates are purely amateur-based, but I'm going to say there were 20,000 people showed up at the Hall of Science in Queens for the Makers Fair. They ranged everywhere in age from probably about 10 on the low end to, you know, guys in their 50s and 60s and 70s. Basically, people interested in building stuff. And radio technology has a lot to, you know, plays a lot into this. Ham radio was represented by the Hozark Club was there. There was another group there showing some projects that they had built using ham radio and other technologies. The booths were various people either selling plans, selling parts to make them, basically commercial and amateur enterprises that were offering various assistance in people getting started in this. I did not particularly go to watch any of them operate. I had other interests while I was there, but there was a very definite presence. Sorry about that, my radio just timed out. There's very definitely a presence of this, and it was all electric-powered stuff.
And before I pick up the person who wanted to make a comment, you're right on the money with that one, Bernie. 10 years ago, the only way you could develop enough horsepower to power some of these larger quarter-scale radio-controlled aircraft, these really high-power helicopters and whatever, would be essentially a chainsaw engine in miniature form running on gasoline or other kinds of alcohol-bearing fuel. So internal combustion engines were the main source of power 10 or 15 years ago. Around that time, Europe in particular started developing electric-powered aircraft. Part of that breakthrough came from brushless DC motors with very fancy ESCs, as they call it, electronic speed control. In other words, there's a kind of an electronic circuit being used in almost all of these electric-powered RC aircraft where the very fancy waveform for the three-phase AC motor, brushless DC motor, is being generated by this ESC circuit, and it does an extremely efficient job, so the electronics has come a long way. What used to be flea-powered electronic aircraft now go into the many horsepower, many kilowatts of energy, and some of these are 20, 30, 40-pound aircraft that can move at ridiculously high velocity. Chris and I saw some of those being flown last weekend, and although you may call it a model airplane, by my standards, that is a remotely piloted vehicle, and thank goodness these guys are nice, friendly people who don't have any criminal intent, so to speak, because these aircraft, wow, the things that they could do. Some of the smaller aircraft with four or six propellers all set up as helicopters, these quadcopters and hexcopters with cameras on board, boy, can they do some fancy things. People make the mistake.
Repeater, timeout.
I was starting to say, people make the mistake of calling them drones. However, one of the guys we met at that event is a man who is supporting the Department of Defense as a recent graduate of Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And boy, can this guy build very high technology, extremely small aircraft. And so when it comes to the remotely piloted systems, that's the official DOD word for them, that are being used in Afghanistan as we speak in order to do surveillance and reconnaissance and so on. These remotely piloted systems are required. They're saving an awful lot of manpower, saving an awful lot of American lives. And this particular guy, this radio-controlled enthusiast of the Department of Defense, recognized what skill he had, and therefore they got him to volunteer as a person who hasn't been drafted, but they got him to volunteer to go to Afghanistan to teach other pilots how to fly these things as well as he does. Okay, there's another person who wanted to make a comment. Please give me a call that is a little bit more slowly, and your name, sir. K2LAW on the TechNet.
Good evening,
morning, Dick. Name here is Mike. Call signs KA2DUT, Kilo Alpha 2 Delta Uniform Tango. And I'm an owner, I'm a pilot, but I also own a quadcopter. So was there a question about frequencies, I think? Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Mike. Tell us about your quadcopter. Hopefully your quadcopter has got a camera on board, or someday will have a camera on board. Hopefully you have the ability to do what's called first-person piloting, a real fun type thing. How long have you been doing that? Christopher was asking what frequencies are allowed, from your point of view, to control your quadcopter. I'm guessing you're doing it on 2 gigs if you bought commercial equipment, but as a ham radio operator, you're not restricted in that way. And Christopher was also asking about telemetry. In other words, he and I are extremely interested in getting a feedback from the airplane. Altitude, velocity, rate of climb, temperature, and so on. Battery voltages. To get that kind of information fed back from the airplane. In the old days, that required all kinds of rigmarole. Nowadays, you buy the right radio control transmitter, and all of that is built in. So tell us anything about your quadcopter you want to, and anything above, Mike. You got the floor. KA2, Delta Uncle Tango. Here we go. Delta Uncle Tango. Yeah, I had it right. K2RW, you got it, Mike.
Well, thanks, Dick. I just kind of got into this the last 8 months. I'm a filmmaker. I've been in photography and started in film about 20 years ago. So I just got into the quadcopter thing about 6 months ago because the technology with this stuff is so insane. The six-axis gyros or tiny chips, the electric compasses, the algorithms for stabilization are insane. Like, literally, if you let go of the controls, it'll do an auto-GPS hover. If the battery runs out, I actually have a go-home feature. It actually will come home and land itself. As far as frequency, there's 900 megahertz, there's a 1.2, I think, megahertz, there's a 2 gig frequency. And for video, I have a 5.6 gig, and I have a real-time downlink, and I have goggles to put on.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, everybody has to wait for the four beeps before they start transmitting. And we heard everything you said, Mike, up to I have goggles that I put on. So please repeat what you said beyond that. Also, when I go to your QRZ.com website, I have the impression that you are working in the broadcast industry. I suspect when it comes to special effects, you help them. I see your call letter, your QSL card has what looks like a Cessna aircraft in it with smoke coming out of it, which I imagine was something to do with special effects. So give us a few words on that. Sounds like you've got a fun occupation there, Mike. KA2DUT, K2LAW.
It's about the four beats thing, I forgot. Yeah, I'm a pilot. That's a 1970 Cessna aerobat, and the smoke system has actually, that's actually really smoke coming out of it. When I do loops and aerobatic maneuvers, it actually ejects smoke rail on the exhaust system and burns that, so that's it. But back to the quadcopter, yeah, we do a bunch of, I do have the real-time goggles you can put on. It's about a 5.6 gig downlink, and I have a little GoPro high def that I put on it. And also on the quadcopter is a two-axis stabilization system that reads off the GPS that counters all the moves of the helicopter. Back to you, Dick.
Boy, that sounds like fun stuff. So I can tell that you're enjoying that occupation. So I think we've gotten some of the questions you're asking, Chris. I guarantee there's more. There's still this huge gulf, as I see it, this non-overlap of these two hobbies, radio-controlled aircraft and ham radio, and the fact that more people are not in one or the other. You may have heard my story about a aircraft event that I entered 15 years ago, in which I think there were about 25 pilots, and only one of those pilots had a ham radio license, me. And the call letters were, KQLIW was a card that was pasted to the wing of my aircraft, and many people asked me, what is that? The fact that I had to explain it to them disappointed me. Okay, back to you, Chris. I know that you didn't get all the answers. KB2IQN, but we're allowed to ask the question again. KQLIW and TechNet. You got it, Chris.
W-O-2-Z.
Stand by a minute, Chris. W-O-2-Z. Anything you know on this subject, please tell us. Start up with your name.
Well, good night, Dick, and good night to all the members of the net. My name is Ian, India Alpha November, and I, too, have recently gotten into RC helicopters. a 2-gig band. Just looking at the back of one of the manuals that came with the transmitter, it says this device complies with Part 15 of the FCC rules. And there are two clauses. One, the device should not cause any harmful interference. And it must accept any interference received. And in the operating frequency, it says compliant with applicable regulations governing radio transmitters in the 2.4 gig to 2.483 gigahertz frequency range. And there are also some FAA recommendations when operating these devices.
The FAA requirements strikes me as something really to be considered. When you see some of these electric-powered, many horsepower, many kilowatt, many pound aircraft being flown by radio control enthusiasts, and these things can easily fly 150 miles an hour. That's a lot of kinetic energy. You fly that high enough, near enough to an airport, guarantee you create a lot of mischief. I'm pretty sure the rule book for the AMA, which Christopher and I should be getting in the mail very soon, and I remember seeing that rule book in past years. My first AMA membership was way back in the mid-50s, and I have a four-number, whereas nowadays they're issuing seven-number type licenses for the AMA. What I'm getting at is the rule book was a very complete thing describing each one of the classes of model aircraft, not all of them RC, although RC is now the biggest section, in my opinion, of model aircraft enthusiasts. But the rule book gives you a lot of individual rules that should be complied with to create safety for people, other aircraft, and so on, in order for your $10 million worth of liability insurance to be properly honored. Anything further you want to add to that, Ian, go right ahead. W02Z. And by the way, you have already, if I understand correctly, done quadcopter feedback, so to speak, W02Z, KQLIW.
Negative, Dick. Just a regular, RC, right? Transmitter and copter. But just some of the quick recommendations, or information provided by the FAA, and they recommend not flying in congested areas, not flying above 400 feet, not flying within 3 miles of an airport, and they also make suggestions on like contacting your local, air traffic facilities like the towers or the centers for their recommendations. Not sure how well that's going to go over. I know you've done some flying, and most of the times they're pretty busy. I too have done some flying too, so I don't know how helpful they're going to be for somebody trying to fly RCs. But they also warn about flying in traffic patterns, final approach runways and so forth. So I know some are the transmitters, some of the more exotic ones or more expensive ones. You can actually adjust the power output on them. And I know there are also several standards in the U.S. versus Europe that, they have to comply with. So, but I'm sure there's tons of information and probably a lot more people out there, maybe not on the net tonight, that could provide some additional info.
Yeah, the 400 feet limitation, if you're in a residential area and anywhere within an airport, that makes a lot of sense. Although the Chernobyl, New York is the name of the town. Pleasant Valley is the name of this recreation area, a camping area, where this event is held on what looks to me like about a 300-acre, nice cleared field in the middle of the woods. Many of those 350 pilots that we saw, 375 pilots, have aircraft that radio-controlled, electrically powered aircraft, that if the guy decides to do a maneuver where he launches the thing by hand or takes it off from the ground, doesn't matter, once the thing is airborne, he aims it straight up, guns the engine, and that thing can go out of sight in about 7 or 8 seconds. And I think we're talking about a couple of thousand feet here. Out of sight by my eyesight. These guys probably have better eyes than I do, although I haven't seen anybody using binoculars yet to fly their model airplane. But these guys get a great deal of fun out of making the thing climb vertical so that it's essentially out of sight, cut the engine, guide it back down toward the ground, and pull out at some very dramatic altitude and start doing all kinds of fancy maneuvers. What these things can do is just out of sight. So for those who are interested in both aeronautics and boats, cars, and radio control, and radio, and wireless, and telemetry, there's a beautiful mixture there, as you can tell. So I think you've gotten some of the answers you're looking for, Chris. KB2IQN, Mobile, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Very good, KB2IQN. Okay, let me explain where I'm coming from this. Maybe it'll help. In searching for certain pieces of technology for doing telemetry, I end up going to a site called doityourselfdrones.com, DIYdrones.com. And there you can look into all kinds of electronics you can put on your own drone craft, right, and create your own drone craft. And they've got things like some lightweight styrofoam planes that you can put all kinds of equipment in and so forth. And then, you know, you see videos for people flying drones with first-person viewing. And one of the things I noticed was someone was doing a distance test to find out how far he could go before the video would drop out. And unfortunately, the radio controls dropped out first. So he still saw the plane, you know, saw what the plane was seeing, but couldn't control the plane. Now, this is where I'm kind of coming from when it comes to the ham radio portion, right? So let me drop. So for the ham radio portion, you're allowed to transmit a higher power there. When it comes to identifying, now that's got to do with modulation. It doesn't necessarily have to be Morse code, because there's certain frequency ranges, let's say for packet radio, where in the modulation for packet radio, that's where your call sign is for the, you know, when you make a transmission in packet radio, your call sign's in the same modulation as the packet radio protocol, whatever the protocol is, whether it's, you know, phase shift keying or frequency shift keying, etc., etc. So I'm wondering, you know, can you do spread spectrum and put your call letters in spread spectrum? Can you do telemetry? That's kind of where I'm coming from. Like, can you do what you do at 2.4 gigahertz unlicensed in, you know, a licensed ham band? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of sharing going on spectrum-wise between 802.11 fraction of a watt type unlicensed things versus these also fraction of a watt radio control transmitters versus ham radio, which is allowed a hell of a lot higher power at certain frequencies in there, but you've got to be identifying. And so I think the FCC describes a number of methods by which you're allowed to identify, and ain't completely clear. What I think you're going, Chris, is that you'd like to have the ability to go to a much higher power output during the time that the aircraft is starting to run out of what I call uplink ranging. In other words, the data from the transmitter to the aircraft, if that falls below the threshold of the aircraft receiver, that's a very undesirable situation. Although, as Ian and Mike were telling us, there are ways that you can have it automatically go to a safe mode. In some cases, some of these aircraft have a global positioning satellite receiver on board, and the safe mode is that it automatically will go back to home base location and slowly land, so to speak. You can do that kind of controlling these days. Anybody with any further information on radio control, give me your call letters right now before we go to the next person. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Victor Echo 3, X-ray Sierra Hotel.
Kilo Charlie 2, Foxtrot Yankee Juliet.
Okay, Yankee Juliet, but first I heard it, X-ray Sierra Hotel. Victor Echo 3, X-ray Sierra Hotel. I should know you. Tell me your name, sir, and what is radio control like in Canada, possibly in the Golden Horseshoe of Canada? VE3XSH, K2RAW, go right ahead.
Hi there, yeah, this is Victor Echo 3, X-ray Sierra Hotel in Toronto, and my name is Christian, and I've done quite a bit of drone flying, and I guess you guys were talking about sending signals off of the drone craft, and I just wanted to mention and talk about the business where, you know, the best gear for moving a video signal off of the plane is 2.4 gigahertz, and the best signal for transmitting to the airplane is 2.4 gigahertz, and to what extent, you know, we're getting interference, and the gear is sort of actually interfering with each other. Yeah, actually, my favorite craft, by the way, if people are interested in getting into this, is the Park Zone Striker. And what you do basically with the Striker is do not buy the off-the-shelf complete built model with the radio. Go into the back of a hobby shop and look if you can find a spare parts one for about $20. So instead of spending about $200 or $250 on a whole kit that's got subpar electronics, just go and pay $20 for the styrofoam replacement fuselage and load it up with all of your own electronics, and then you don't feel bad about, you know, making serious modifications to it. But, I mean, I know just with my own playing around with video that you've got to put the airplane's receiver and the video transmitter quite far apart on the actual rig just so that they don't interfere with each other. And I just am curious to know if people have had 2.4 gigahertz interference with their flying drones. Thanks very much, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Very fine, Christian. Thank you. By the way, Christian mentioned in his Park Zone Striker, there's a whole class of radio control aircraft called Park Flyers, P-A-R-K Flyers, people who literally fly them in a park. And in some cases, they're small enough, slow enough moving, light enough that you can fly them in a living room and certainly fly them inside of gyms. And so some of the Long Island radio control enthusiast groups will book a gym once every month, where on a weekend, for instance, the gym of a high school is not being used, and they fly their aircraft there. And so they're having a good deal of fun with it. Without a doubt, if you've got thoroughly independent transmitters and receivers that are co-located, the transmitter can easily descend to your receiver. However, one of these transmitters that Christopher and I own now has telemetry built into it, and as such, I am guessing that the machine does it by timesharing. In other words, there are certain pulses coming out of the transmitter going to the receiver. There are certain pulses coming out of the receiver going back to the transmitter, the pilot, so to speak. And I think they're interstitially time domain doing it such that one is not jamming the other simultaneously. That's a guess on my part. As Christopher and I look further into this particular system that we purchased, maybe we'll find out more about that as to how it's actually being done. Or it could be done on separate ham bands with very good filtering, but where you're sharing one single band, and so you've got to worry about desensitization. And what I think Christian, what I think Christian is suggesting is that that guy who ran into a problem where his first-person aircraft that was sending him back video ran out of range on the radio control transmitter, quite possible that the video transmitter on board was creating desensitization of the aircraft receiver, and that could be a contributing factor as to why he ran out of range. We'll soon find out more about that. I didn't get the full set of call letters, but it ended in Yankee Juliet, I think it was. Please give me your full set of calls, your name, and then your information, sir. K2RIW in the Tech Magic.
Hey, Dick, it's Harry, KC2FYJ. I had two little tidbits, one harking back to the just previous conversation about the large model airplanes. I happened to peruse the AMA site. They've got a 29-page document describing their large model airplane program, and the restrictions in it are quite severe, all safety-oriented. They're talking about planes weighing 55 to 70 pounds, I mean really heavy stuff. You might find that interesting to go look at. And the second point was, I'm wondering if anyone has considered incorporating a Raspberry Pi into a drone. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's a full-function Linux computer on a credit card size, and it can incorporate wireless to connect to an internet port, and it can run off of some AA or AAA battery for quite a long period of time, and so that you could use that to do all sorts of automated command and control. Plus, it has a camera attachment that's available that's a very high-resolution video camera, and you could incorporate that for allowing your video feedback to come back over the Internet. KC2FYK, back to TestNet.
I thank you, Harry. A lot of good information there. 55 to 70 pounds for an aircraft, radio controlled model airplane. Wow. I knew they got big. I knew they got heavy. I didn't think it went that far. My goodness, is that a weapon? Can you imagine something that heavy moving that fast? If it struck something that it shouldn't strike, human or house or whatever, my goodness, can that thing do damage? Christopher is quite heavy into Linux-type systems, so this Ruby Pi Linux thing sounds like something to be looked into. Good information, and thank you, Harry. I think we've dwelled long enough on this one. We ought to move on. So glad you brought that to our attention, Chris. I'm going to go to the next guy, who was Joe. Joe created one hell of a incident last week. He didn't know it.
Minor correction.
Yeah, go ahead, Harry.
Yeah, it's a Raspberry Pi, not a Ruby Pi. Raspberry Pi. It's a Linux system using an ARM chip, so it's not Windows compatible, but it's $35 for the credit card thing with 512 meg of memory, and it's got a really, really big following. You can find out more detail by going to raspberrypi.org.
Okay, Don, good information, Harry. Chris, in case you need a fill on any of that, let me send it over to Chris. KB2IQN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Wait, Jubian.
Yes, I'm quite familiar with the Raspberry Pi, so I know about that. I have not quite seen any of them in a plane yet, but they have the equivalent. They have a, on the do-it-yourself drone site, they have an Android or something with an ARM chip that's specifically designed for hooking up to radio controls and doing telemetry and GPS and automatic control via GPS and a whole lot of other things. So they have something very similar. Back to net.
Would be the Arduino chip, and the difference being Raspberry Pi is a Linux OS, Arduino is individual custom programs with no underlying OS.
Yes, roger that. I think it was an Arduino. I'm familiar with that as well. That's an embedded system versus a Linux system, yes. They also have a new Arduino that has a Linux chip on board called, I think it's a, I can't remember what it was called. It was a three-letter UA or a YUD or something like that. I can't remember. But I was looking at that now. It's kind of fascinating, where you have both Linux and Arduino on the same board. What else? I can't remember. Back to net.
Hey, sir, Jack. Okay, Eric, K2EJ first, and then Harry, if he wants to add any more to that. First, Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, Arduino is built around an Atmel chip. There's a Netrino, which has its own rudimentary operating system. Basically, what they're saying is correct. There's a couple of flavors of Linux that run on Raspberry Pi. I run a couple of Raspberry Pis running several different fixed applications, but I don't know if any of you guys went to the Maker Fair this past weekend, but all the manufacturers were showing a lot of their good stuff. You know, all sorts of robotics using Arduino, Raspberry Pi, and a few others. And coincidentally, the controllers that we use for the computers are built around the Atmel chip, which is basically a RISC processor, the reduced instruction set chip, and it works very well.
Thank you, Eric. Anyone else want to add anything further or any further questions on this particular subject? Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW.
Victor Echo 3 X-ray, Sierra Hotel.
Go right ahead, Christian.
Thanks. Yeah, just a closing note regarding drone aircraft and Arduinos and whatnot. In aircraft and space development, they talk about a need statement. So it's, you know, they're trying to say, here are the needs that we need to fulfill, and then the designers go ahead and try to meet those needs. And one of the drones that's got a very important need statement right now is something that would be used by, like, Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, and it's the kind of plane that they would send off a ship to a chosen coordinate far away, and it would land on the water, you know, like a Catalina, and it would stop in the water, and it would take a little water sample, and it would take it into the plane, and then it would either, using an Arduino, device, you know, analyze and radio back what the contents are, or just physically carry the contents back to the plane, or back to the boat. And it's for, you know, people are looking to do this kind of stuff for research reasons and scientific environmental reasons. And then also if there's some onboard video, that helps as well. But yeah, you're looking at sort of an environmental scout. And I've been hearing a lot lately from various sort of institutions that they're looking for these devices, and they're looking for people to get them out into situations like the Pacific, and, you know, people in Hawaii might like to use this to sort of fly out, you know, west to find out what the water's doing just off their coast. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Christian. I can see that this unmanned aerial vehicles, we haven't heard the end of that yet. we're just scratching the surface. There's a lot these things are going to be able to do, and a lot they're already doing. So this combination of wireless equipment, computers, and aircraft, it's just a flash in the pan. It's got no real future. Nothing's going to go there. Obviously, that's a pure joke. That's your drastic understatement. Okay, we'll be discussing that more in future weeks, I can tell. I'm going to move on to Joe. Joe, you created quite a situation last weekend. I wonder if you're going to do it again this weekend. KC2QIW, K2LIW in the TechNet. You got it, Joe.
Hey, Roger, that. Want to say hi to everybody to the net. Name here is Joe, KC2, Queen, Yankee, Whiskey. Oh, okay, yeah, thank you. My next question is, amateur radio is getting really, really popular. I notice when I do my school runs, I see dipoles up there and amateur radio antennas and whatnot, and so I guess it is getting really popular. So my question is, do you think in the future they're going to start charging us monthly fees to use the equipment? I hope not. I don't know if the FCC is going to want to do this, or even our government is going to start charging us monthly fees to use amateur radio. Back to the net.
I think I see what you're worried about, Joe, and I think there's nothing to worry about there. The FCC rules make it awfully clear that no remuneratory concept can take place. In other words, no cash flow is allowed to take place as a result of ham radio. I think their intent is to make sure that people don't misuse ham radio to run their taxi cab business or their oil delivery business or something like that. And when ham radio operators used to, in the beginning, use a phone patch by which from their automobile they dial the right kind of tones, go into a local repeater, get on the telephone, and order a pizza, and then drive to that place to pick it up. That was in the gray zone. I know that there was an awful lot of discussions going on at the time. Should a ham radio operator be allowed to do that? Because inadvertently cash is flowing. And eventually, I think the ARL found a way of making a dispensation for that, because the ham would have made that exact same phone call from a payphone if he had to. He would have made the exact same purchase of the pizza, so to speak. So the ham radio was not really creating the cash flow. Let me drop. So my whole understanding is that since the FCC has such strict rules, in fact, one other place where it got very sticky is where you have a paid radio operator operating the equipment for all of the schedules of the American Radio Relay League. They've got code practice schedules and whatever. And that is a paid man who is operating that radio equipment in order to create all of those schedules, to put on all of those tapes and transmitters at the right period of time. And I knew that the ARL had a fairly sticky period there where they weren't quite sure where they, within the letter of the law, where a man who was a paid employee was using these ham radio frequencies. And I'm pretty sure the answer eventually came back that, hey, he's supplying this service to make sure that the amateurs that are doing code practice sessions and wanted to listen to the ARL at that period of time, he was just making sure that it was taking place. The hams themselves were not creating the cash flow to this man. It was the American Radio Relay doing it. And if he wasn't controlling those transmitters, he'd be doing some of the function for them. So I think they eventually knowledge. There will be no cash flow due to ham radio usage. That's my understanding. You guys who are listening probably have another understanding.